today I'm here with Alison Singer, who runs the Autism Science Foundation. She's based here in New York, and she used to work with Autism Speaks. Alison, take it away. Tell us a bit about yourself.
Well, as you said, I am the founder and president of the Autism Science Foundation. We were founded 2 years ago to focus on funding very much needed autism research. I think what I'm most proud of is that we started funding science in our first year of operations, and we've increased our funding levels every year. In just 2 years of running the Autism Science Foundation, we've already funded just under $500,000 in scientific grants. And our funds mostly support pre- and postdoctoral fellowships. These are students who work with established research mentors who are investigating the causes of autism and are developing new treatments for autism. And these grants are already producing results. You know, we funded a new mouse model of autism and a new intervention strategy that utilizes the recess period at school to help children with autism work on social skills. So I'm very excited about the work we're doing. I'm very grateful for the tremendous support that the community has provided for the Autism Science Foundation. We couldn't do any of this without our volunteers, our donors, our friends in the media, particularly the social media, and they're the ones who make it all possible.
And so maybe can we walk through like how this works? I mean, so you're, it's, I don't know the right word, but I'll just say like the business term, it's effectively your business model is that you raise funds from people interested in trying to solve the autism problem. And then you filter that through to through some sort of process that you have that then goes to the organizations or people that you believe that are doing the best research on the spectrum.
Well, what we believe is that the greatest gifts that we can offer our family members with autism are love and scientific research. And that may sound silly, but when you think about it, research is what will help our children and our adults with autism to grow and improve and live the best lives possible. And that's really what they're entitled to at the end of the day. So we raise money from the autism community and from outside the autism community as well, and we use that money to fund autism research. We fund in all areas of autism research. We look particularly at what causes autism and how we can develop better treatments. But we have really focused in on funding young investigators, as I said, pre-doctoral students and post-doctoral students who are just entering, who are just beginning their careers in autism research, who in many cases have very new, novel, exciting ideas for new ways to approach problems that we've been grappling with or issues that we've been grappling with, who really just need a little bit of money to do some preliminary data. And then our hope and our expectation is that they will take the preliminary data that's funded through our grants, and they'll leverage that into much larger NIH grants. So that's one of the
things. So it sounds like you've read the structure of scientific revolution.
Yes. Well, you know, we didn't make up that model, clearly, but we definitely believe in that. And we also think it's very important to be building a pipeline of researchers. You know, we're not going to find the answers in 5 years. We really need to be making sure that we are encouraging the best and brightest young scientists to study autism as opposed to studying other diseases. And sometimes by being able to offer them a grant early in their career and by pairing them with a well-established scientific mentor who's done a lot of great work, who's a pioneer, who's leading the field in autism research, by pairing them and encouraging their career early in their career, we're really able to attract the best and the brightest into autism research. And that's what it's going to take. We need the smartest people working on these issues because the issues are very challenging.
Are you familiar with the seed investment model or angel investing in the internet world?
I'm not exactly sure what you're referring to.
So in the startup community, it's a very common, it's basically how a huge amount of startups are getting started right now, is there's guys going out, they help a lot of people, they create a lot of awareness, a lot of hopeful entrepreneurs go and find them, they do small investments of $10,000 to $50,000, maybe $100,000 at the most, but you know, the size keeps shrinking because it's easier and easier to start internet businesses. And out of those, it's presumed that, you know, most will fail, but one or two will somehow get some traction, and then they'll go on and be funded by a VC. And that's becoming, that's actually been institutionalized more or less with a company called Y Combinator, run out in California, where they've sort of systematized this whole process. There's one here in New York. It's around the country, but it's got a base here in New York, Techstars. And it basically sounds like you're doing the same thing.
Well, that is, in fact, exactly the model that we are using. We know that if we can reach the smartest, youngest scientists when they are at the early stages of their career, we know that we can do a lot to attract them to the field, and we can make sure that they are learning from the best researchers, that we can make sure that they have funds to attend the important conferences, like the International Meeting for Autism Research or the Society for Neuroscience, and that way we can jumpstart their careers. And they really want to make a commitment, in many cases, to autism research. A lot of times it's just lack of funding. And funding is tough to come by in this market. Most organizations and the NIH are cutting back on funding for pre-doctoral fellows and for postdoctoral fellows. And I and our board think this is tragic, that it's critical to make sure that we have a future and that there are researchers who are committed and who are going to stay in autism research.
So for anyone listening that is interested in helping fund, what are the types of people that tend to come and want to give to you? How much do they give? How does that work? Like, how does all of that come together?
Well, we have donors who have given donations from $5 to $50,000. We also, I should say, less than $5. We have some students who have given even less. So, you know, any donation is very welcome. We pool all of the funds together. And I think what we are able to offer donors is the opportunity to pool funds and then to have the grants evaluated by our scientific advisory board, which is comprised of the top autism researchers from around the world. And that way we're able to pick the best studies and really make sure that our funders are donating to work that is going to really have impact. And already the grants that we funded, as I mentioned earlier, are starting to have impact. Even though it's only been a short time, we are already starting to see results, and we are seeing some of our early funders able to get NIH grants as a result of the data that they collected through our pre-doctoral fellowship. So that's very exciting. But we encourage donors who are interested in rigorous research to take a look at what we're funding on our website. I think what differentiates us from other autism organizations is that our focus is really on funding the research and on disseminating the research. And that's a critical component. A lot of research is being done now. A lot of great information is coming out of the research that's been funded. But it doesn't do anyone any good if people don't know about it. So if new treatment protocols are being developed, families need to know about them so that they can contact their school district or they can talk to teachers. The other piece of our mission, in addition to funding science, is on dissemination of science. And we do that through our website. We do that through all of our social media activities. We do that by sponsoring conferences for parents and conferences for special educators. So this fall, actually, we have two educational symposiums. We just completed one in California that was for families. That was really aimed at helping them understand some of the issues that their families will experience and how they might use assistive technologies. And then later this fall, the end of this month, we have a conference coming up in New York that's targeted at teachers, special education teachers and regular education teachers, to help them understand and implement some of the new evidence-based interventions that are designed to be used in schools. So again, that's a really critical piece of what we do, because I don't think that research should exist in a vacuum. I think whenever we look at what we're funding, we make sure that there is real value for families, and we include, as part of the application process, we ask the scientists to say, how will the information that comes out of this study help real people? And that's very different. A lot of times the scientists are not used to thinking in those terms. They're used to thinking in, how will this contribute to the body of scientific knowledge? But what we're interested in as a parent and family-based advocacy group is, how will this new science change people's lives for the better? And how can we help people to know what's going on in the scientific community so that they can implement the new evidence-based interventions?
So let's say I'm a grad student and I've got a great idea and I want to get some money to go and do it. How do I do that? I call you up, I send you guys an email. Like, how does all of that stuff work?
Well, the application for grants is posted on our website. Right now we are, in fact, in a round soliciting pre- and postdoctoral grants. The applications are due at the end of December. So it's a very short application process. We honestly don't want scientists to spend time writing a 20-page application. We want them in the lab doing science. And frankly, I think if you can't explain what you want to do and why it's important in 5 pages, then you have an issue. So the application is posted.
You sound tough, my friend.
Yeah, people have said that. But the application is on our website, and I would encourage anyone who is a pre-doctoral student or a postdoctoral fellow who's interested in really having more opportunities or doing a project of their own in addition to the work with their university to apply. I think it's a great program. We also provide funds for all of our grantees to go to the International Meeting for Autism Research so that they have an opportunity to network with the top scientists who are doing the cutting-edge research. And I think a lot of our grantees have said that that experience really made a difference, that they were able to talk to, for example, the director of the National Institute of Mental Health who sat next to them at one of the conferences. So, you know, those opportunities are unique.
And what's the typical grant size?
Our pre-doctoral grants are between $25,000 and $30,000, and our postdoctoral grants are between $35,000 and $40,000 each year.
And so that then you send them that money, and then they go off and do their research, and then they submit back a paper, and you know things go forward. Is that generally how it works?
We expect.
Well, I guess you review their application with your body of scientists. Is that how that first step works?
The scientific review board and the grant review committee looks at all the applications, and they basically score them. And every year we get many, many more applications that score in the fundable range than we are able to fund. And honestly, that breaks my heart. People will always ask me, oh, the day you choose the grant, how you're going to fund must be such an exciting and wonderful day for you. And it is, but it's also a heartbreaking day for me because so often great projects are left on the table unfunded. And that I consider my personal challenge. I would like to get to the point where all of the grant applications that score in the fundable range are able to be funded, and that we are able to raise enough money to fund all of the research that needs to be funded. I mean, we're now in a position in the autism research community where there is way more great research waiting to be done than there is money to fund it. And that, to me, that's my personal challenge. That's what motivates me from a fundraising point of view every day. I want to raise enough money to fund all of the research that needs to be funded.
And this is a pretty personal thing for you because you have a brother on the spectrum and you have a child on the spectrum.
I have an older brother who's diagnosed with autism, and then I have my 14-year-old daughter, Jody, who's also diagnosed with autism, and I have another daughter, Lauren, who's 12 years old, and I'm really motivated by all three of them, as well as by all of the families that I talk to every day and the stories that they tell about their children and their siblings. And their spouses with autism. There's so much that we need to do, and so many answers that we need. So yeah, that's what motivates me.
When you say are they classical autism, or I mean, like, I'm diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome. So are they like me, or are they more on the classical end of the spectrum?
They're both much more challenged. My brother has had a very challenging life, including having spent time in Willowbrook, which is one of the most notorious of the institutions in New York State. He was diagnosed in the 1960s. My mother was basically told that he was autistic because she was a bad mother.
Was he diagnosed with autism, though? He didn't get diagnosed with schizophrenia?
No, he was diagnosed with autism.
Hmm.
And my mother...
And your mother was a bad mother. I mean, that would have been great for her to hear.
Yeah. And that she should try harder with her other child, which was me.
Oh, gee.
You know, that's tragic. Imagine, at least now we know that autism is not the cause of bad parenting, and we know that the parents of children with autism are among the most loving and dedicated of all parents. But imagine being told that as a mother who loves her child and is seeking help from the medical community to be told that, well, your child's autistic because you're a bad mother. My brother has really struggled. Back in the 1960s when he was diagnosed, there was no IDEA law, so there was nothing, there were no laws to protect him or even send him to school. He was considered uneducatable because he, in addition to being diagnosed with autism, was diagnosed with mental retardation, has significant cognitive impairment, never learned to speak, never learned really to communicate in any way, and is severely challenged. I always wonder what his life would have been like if he had had access to early intervention or to any intervention or even had had the opportunity to go to school. He didn't go to school until he was, I think, 10 or 11. So, that was...
Yeah, I mean, there's that little girl in Canada. There's that little girl in Canada that was brought from being nonverbal to... brought from being non-anything to being nonverbal but being able to use a computer, which is pretty incredible.
Well, that's really the message I always try to communicate to people, is that the window doesn't close. The learning window doesn't magically close when children turn 3 or 5 or 21, which is when the legal window closes. My brother, we continue to try to teach him language using different types of techniques like PECs and other techniques. He wasn't even toilet trained until he was in his 30s, but now we've accomplished that. And let me tell you, the world opens up to you when you are able to leave the house. Now he's able to participate in a program where he delivers meals on wheels to homebound senior citizens 3 mornings a week. He's now a contributing member of the community. But, you know, he never would have had that opportunity if we had given up on teaching adults new skills.
I think that's important to hear here. Like, people hear about autism and they know that it kind of sucks and, you know, it causes problems. But the concept of not being able to basically do anything until you're toilet trained, I mean, that's heavy stuff. This is a big problem.
But it's a surmountable obstacle. You can't just say, well, we tried and tried, and now he's 30, and it's not going to happen. You have to keep trying. You have to keep trying new techniques, and if one method is not working, try another one. But there's no reason to give up. I mean, I think he's a perfect example of that. And we won't.
What was it that? What was it that eventually worked in his case that clicked and got him to do it?
It was really the dedication of a very committed therapist. I have to tell you, we owe so much to teachers and therapists who work with our kids and our brothers and sisters with autism. They really are unrecognized angels on earth. And it was really someone who just was not going to take no for an answer and was willing to work with him and basically move into the bathroom and be in there for weeks until he was able to achieve enough successful attempts. So, you know, it's just that kind of tenacity and not taking no for an answer. But I think it's easier to give up. It's easier to say, well, you know, all these people have tried and it's never happened. But, you know, that doesn't move us forward.
Who takes care of him? I mean, as your parents are older, like, you know, who takes care of your brother?
He's now in a great group home in Rockland County, and he has a terrific service provider. He goes to a wonderful day program where he is working in the morning delivering meals on wheels, and he's also now training for a program where he shops. They go to supermarkets and they shop for homebound senior citizens. So there's absolutely a job for everyone. It's just a question of finding the right job and finding people who are willing to support the attempt and the effort to be a contributing member of society. I think too many people write off people with autism, particularly adults with autism who have cognitive disability, think they're the easiest to write off because they don't have language. They often can't advocate on their own behalf. They really need family members to help others understand what it is that they want and need. I think that...
Is he able to understand language when you talk to him?
Not so much, but I think he's able to express joy. And we can see which activities he's engaged in when he's expressing joy.
Right.
So even though he doesn't communicate verbally, he's still able to communicate. He's still able to let me and others who work with him who live in his house understand what makes him happy.
But so if you say simple words to him, he can't understand any simple language at all?
He can understand, I think, a few simple words. He can, but it's tough to know.
It's tough to know.
Again, because he never had any intervention when he was younger. So it's still very, very challenging to know what he understands and what he doesn't understand and what he really wants and what he doesn't want. But the key is to not stop trying.
Right. No, I agree. In terms of the work that you guys fund, do you fund more on the low end of the spectrum or the high end of the spectrum?
We fund the best studies. So when the studies come in, we look for which are the most scientifically meritorious and which are most likely to produce information that's of real value to families. So, I mean, we fund really all across the scientific spectrum. We have funded grants that look at language development, that look at social functioning, that look at stereotypical disorders. We are interested, we've had some that looked at caregiving, so issues about how parents can do their best to work with kids with autism. We are funding a lot that's looking at how we can move from some of the genetics work that we have started to fund and try to turn that into treatment. But we definitely, you know, need more research to understand what causes autism. And then we need to start to move from what causes autism into how we can take what we've learned from the genetic studies, for example, and translate them into treatment. And that's happening. You know, that's to me the most exciting area of autism research, that we're now able to make animal models, mouse models, that have the autism genes. And the amazing thing is that these mice show signs of autism. They show social dysfunction. They show repetitive behaviors. They show difficulty learning. So with the mouse models, we're able to test new psychopharmacological treatments much, much more rapidly than we could with humans. And there are several compounds now that are being tested in the mice that are showing real promise in reversing the learning deficits and the social deficits associated with autism. One compound in particular is already in phase 3 clinical trials in humans. And this is a very promising drug that's targeted at individuals with Fragile X syndrome, but the hope is that it will also work for individuals with other types of autism. So, you know, one thing that we really focused on was making sure that we're testing this compound in children with autism without Fragile X, as well as testing it in children with Fragile X. The idea there being that it may be the same downstream proteins that are affected, but just by a different gene, maybe by a gene that we haven't even found yet to be associated with autism. But this is the area of autism research that's hugely, hugely promising. It's taking all of the genetics work that we've invested in over the last 10 years and really using it in a scientifically rigorous way to develop treatments. I think what we've seen over the past 10 years is that treatment research has been much more art than science. I would take my daughter, for example, to the doctor and say, you know, what are our...
I would agree. I think it feels like a lot of the research is a lot more art than science right now, too, since we still don't know the cause.
Well, that's why we have to focus on the cause. You know, I think people say, well, we have to focus on treatment, but treatment is sort of like throwing things against the wall and seeing what sticks, unless you can say, this is why we think this treatment will work. This is the mechanism of action that, I mean, this is how other diseases are cured. You find out what is the mechanism of action that causes the disorder, and how can we intervene to change the pathway of progression. So when we look at... when we look at treatment, it really needs to be focused on a scientific way. When I, as I was saying a minute ago, when I would take my daughter to the doctor, he would say, well, you could try a little Prozac or you could try a little of this. And I'd say, well, how is it going to work? What's the mechanism of action by which this is going to help? And they would sort of say, well, we don't know, but you could try a little Prozac. Like, well, I don't want to try a little Prozac unless someone can tell me how and why it's going to work. But now, with some of these new...
You sound a little like me. And I mean that in a complimentary way, because I don't put up with that stuff either. It's like, give me some clear answers here. I don't have time for this.
Well, that's what we're seeing now. We're seeing compounds that are designed to either upregulate or downregulate specific proteins that are either lower or higher because of a deletion or a duplication in a specific gene. So that, to me, makes good sense. There, you can explain in a scientifically rigorous way how this particular compound or molecular compound or drug, whatever you want to call it, is going to make a difference, or how, at least theoretically, how it's going to make a difference. Not just, you know, a little Prozac might help her feel better. That's not going to cut it with me or with most parents.
What do you think about the research into mirror neurons?
I couldn't hear what you said.
What do you think about the research into mirror neurons?
In the mirror neurons?
In the research into mirror neurons. Do you not have, not able to hear me okay?
No, I just, you spoke very quickly. I couldn't quite hear what the last
one
was.
Oh, sorry.
I think that all of the research that's looking specifically at, that's more scientifically focused is good. I think a lot of the treatment research and a lot of the research that we've seen has been, as I said earlier, not really directly tied back to cause. So I think when you look at research, or the way we look at research, is it has to be, we have to look at both cause and treatment. And the research that's focused on cause needs to lead logically to treatment, and the research that's focused on treatment needs to have come logically out of the research looking at cause. So I think it needs to be a loop. And, you know, I think certainly the mirror neuron stuff falls into that continuum.
Having done a lot of research myself, my opinion is that it is mirror neurons.
Well, I think the good thing is that we're now asking scientific questions in a way that could be scientifically tested. You know, I think that there's been much more of a shift in the last few years towards at least understanding why it's important to do placebo-controlled, double-blind, randomized studies when it comes to autism, and not to say, well, let's see if there's, you know, not just cause and effect, but more
rigorously proven stuff is what matters. I agree completely, and that's one of the things. And I want to ask you about this. In autism, there's so much drama. Why is this?
Why? I'm sorry. Again, I'm having trouble. What this
is?
What?
If there's so much drama in autism, there's so many like things that happen. Like, why is there so much of this?
Oh, drama. Okay. I think it's because as parents, we love our kids so much, and we love our family members so much, and it's very hard to accept when you're a parent that your child is going to struggle and have all these challenges. And I think it's natural to want to blame someone or something as being the cause. Sometimes that does come across as very dramatic. What we always encourage parents to do is to look at the data. You know, you can't be so focused on your anger and overly dramatic that you lose sight of what the science is saying, because that's not in anyone's interest. It's certainly not in the interest of the kids. So we always encourage families to look at the science and make decisions based on the science. And, you know, it also honestly scares me when you hear these dramatic anecdotes about recovery, or I gave my child a B12 injection and that day he spoke for the first time. You know, we have to keep in mind that there are milestones, and that even with typically developing children, there's one day that a baby is crawling, and then there's one day that child will take his first steps, and it has nothing to do with what that child ate for breakfast that morning. It's just that child was developmentally ready on that day. And so sometimes when you hear these dramatic stories in the media about recovery, a lot of times they lose sight of the fact that children with autism and individuals with autism develop over time.
You don't think that it could be a case that there's like a some sort of sensory interference going on, like, you know, we hear, I mean, I don't have any allergies. I've just been, you know, researching because I find it interesting. But that there could be like a gluten or casein or some other thing. I mean, there's just been so much anecdotal stories of this where it's causing sensory issues, which is impairing the child's, I don't know how to say this, impairing the child's mirror neurons and effectively their ability to relate with the world. And then when those sensory issues are taken away, that the child is then, like, that shock is removed, and then that developmental, exactly as you just mentioned, that sort of, that developmental step is then taken and triggered, and they're then able to move forward.
Well, I think we have to keep in mind, as I said, that children with autism, like all children, develop. Autism is a developmental disability, so children are going to improve, and we certainly have to look for evidence-based ways and evidence-based treatments to help them and to encourage that and to move the process along more quickly. I think what I was trying to get at was some of the dramatic stories that you hear in the press about risky, unproven therapies that really have no evidence of efficacy and can sometimes, you know, do real harm to children. And that there's an opportunity cost here, you know, especially when some of these therapies divert time and energy away from proven therapy. So one thing I find so interesting in our community, honestly, is the huge placebo effect that we're now seeing in so many of the treatment trials. You know, parents will say that their kids are benefiting from a treatment, but often the parents of the kids on a placebo report even better outcomes than the parents of the kids who are receiving the intervention. And again, I think this is because we love our kids so much and we want them to improve, but it really speaks to why it's so important to have rigorous double-blind placebo-controlled trials of these interventions. So with some of these environmental issues, absolutely we have to research them. And I agree that we need to look at the gluten-free diet, the casein-free diet, and we have. And we needed to look at vaccines back in the 1990s. But now that research is done. You know, the good news is that we can ask these questions in a scientific way, and we can answer them. And I think the issue for me and for many of our board members and volunteers comes with being willing to accept what the data show after you invest in the studies. I think.
And this is something I agree completely on. And so you're someone that's looked into this pretty deeply, and obviously you've formed some opinions, so I'm really interested to learn from you. My understanding is that, like, for example, the vaccine area, which gets a little controversial, but my understanding is that there hasn't been a proven connection. There has been no proven, there's no proven connection after a lot of research, which doesn't mean that there isn't a connection. It just means that after a huge amount of research, there hasn't been one that's been able to be found. Is that accurate or is that inaccurate?
No, that's accurate. I think you can't prove a negative. You'll never be able to fund a study that proves that something does not cause something. That's just not
right.
How science works. So
right.
I think when you look at the vaccine studies, what you have to look at is sort of the mountain of evidence, where we now have over 24 studies. You can look at this question in a scientifically rigorous way. You can say, let's look at children who got MMR and children who didn't and see if there's a difference in the rate of diagnosis of autism. Let's look at children who received vaccines that contained thimerosal versus children who got less thimerosal in their vaccines or none. Let's look at children who were vaccinated according to the CDC scientific schedule and children who were vaccinated on a different delayed schedule, and let's see if there's
right.
any difference in their mm-hmm. neurological outcomes. Again, the good news is that these are questions that can be answered by science, and fortunately
right.
now they have been, and many times over. So the question really becomes an issue of being willing to accept what the science tells us. All of the studies have come back showing that there's no relationship between MMR and autism or thimerosal and autism. There's no difference in neurological outcomes for children who received their vaccines according to the CDC schedule versus children who were delayed or who didn't get vaccines. So, you know, again,
Is it the same sort of response in terms of gluten and casein-free diets as well? Is it the same level of certainty as well that the research has shown?
Well, there are not as many studies of the gluten-free diet, but there was a study presented 2 years ago that came out of the University of Rochester that was presented at the International Meeting for Autism Research, and it showed that children who were on the gluten-free diet had no different neurological outcomes. Children with autism who were on the gluten-free diet had no difference in outcomes than children who were on a regular diet. What the studies have shown is that children who are on a dairy-free diet have lower bone density. So, you know, you are introducing some other issues by withholding gluten casein. But there was no difference in outcomes. So, you know, again, what we have to do is we have to look at these questions in a rigorous way. And we are. And that those are the types of studies that we want to fund. Those are the types of studies that hold real value for families. You know, I say this at the NIH all the time, that when you look at a treatment intervention, or when you look at an intervention that families are already using and test for efficacy, either way, however that study comes out, you are providing actionable and useful information for parents. So when you show that an intervention is non-efficacious, that's as valuable to families as showing sometimes that an intervention is efficacious, because you will spare that family and the person with autism the time and the energy and the side effects of trying that intervention.
Right. And this is why I reached out to you, because I am very impressed that you do this in a rigorous way. I mean, you're pretty tough on it, but I agree with being very, very rigorous, and I don't like opinion-based stuff. I think it's got to be analytical and well thought through. So, good job.
Thank you.
What else should we talk about? Where do you think what are some other promising areas of research do you think that are coming down the line?
Well, again, I think the most promising area of research has to do with taking the genetics work and taking the gene studies and translating them into science-based intervention. So that's one area that I think is very promising. I think another area that's incredibly promising is we are now moving into conducting intervention trials in the places where people with autism live and work and go to school. You know, for so long we would do these instructional methods in a laboratory with highly trained psychologists and clinicians. And then when we would try to transfer some of them, like social skills interventions or language-based reciprocal learning, when we would try to transfer them into school, for example, they wouldn't translate. And we would say, well, how come they're not working? They work so well in the lab. Why aren't they working in a school? And it's because in a school, you don't have a highly trained clinician. You have a paraprofessional, or you have an office worker who works at recess. So now we are looking at intervention trials, and we're funding a great one in Philadelphia where we're testing a social skills intervention in a school at recess using the existing personnel that happens to be hired in that school, and really seeing if we can train up the teachers and the playground aides to use some of these interventions. It's a cost-effective model. It's something that, if it works, can be rolled out across the country in a very cost-effective way, because it means that you don't have to hire psychologists. It means you can do these interventions with classroom aides. So that's the type of thing that has real-world application and could be implemented because of the cost-effective component. You know, again, when you're studying interventions that are so expensive, you have to sit back and say, well, even if this proves to be efficacious, no one's ever going to be able to use it. So what's the value? So we really look to fund treatment studies that are done in places where the individuals live and work. We'd love to fund a study that's focused on a workplace, but treatment in the workplace, and that are cost-effective, so that they can be used by real people in the real world.
And do you think we're going to find a cure?
I think we are going to understand what causes autism, and I think we are going to be able to treat it. I think in the last few years, we have already started to change the way we think about cure. I think that, for example, in the mouse models, we are able to see reversal of learning deficits in adult mice that we never thought we would see. I think we used to think that in a developmental disability, if certain neurons didn't come online at the time that they were supposed to early in development, that those neurons would atrophy and those pathways would never be able to be corrected. But what we're seeing, what we're learning from the mouse modeling is that by introducing these compounds and re-regulating the proteins, those pathways can be turned on even in adult mice. And that's a huge change in the way we think about developmental disability. And it's hugely promising because it means that even for teenagers or adults who have not had language, who have struggled cognitively, that there's opportunity for them to regain those skills. You know, we're not going to give someone a pill and all of a sudden someone who hasn't spoken at age 18 is going to start speaking. That's not going to happen.
Right. And there's also there's heavy in learning, which I guess like it's almost like it burns and tracks into the brain, like the way the neural pathways get formed in the brain. And so I would imagine the further you go without hitting like these developmental milestones, then it may be harder, but it would seem like they still could be triggered in some manner.
Well, that's really what we've learned from the mouse modeling, is that even when that we can open up these pathways later in life and we can reintroduce the ability to learn. You know, again, you're not going to give someone a pill and all of a sudden someone who hasn't spoken is going to speak, but what you are going to be able to do is reintroduce learning abilities. And I think that's really the key for a lot of the pharmacological interventions. It's certainly with the pharmacological interventions that are already FDA approved, they don't target the core symptoms of autism, but what they do is they make the children and adults more available for learning opportunities. So, for example, with Risperdal, you know, you may take a child who's aggressive and tantruming, and because of that behavior, they can't participate in some of the evidence-based interventions. But by introducing that medication, you're not curing their autism, but you are reducing some of the symptoms that make it impossible for them to participate in the interventions that do help them. And that's also what we're looking for in some of these new treatments. But they are targeting the core symptoms. These are trying to unblock the blocked pathways that restrict learning. And that's really the key. So if you want to call that cure, then yes, I do think we'll have a cure. But no, I don't think we're going to create a pill that is going to somehow one day someone didn't speak and the next day they did. But we will be able to create opportunities that open up the ability for learning.
So what I was saying is, and just to share yet another unsolicited opinion with you in the space of autism, which, you know, I'm sure you don't have enough of those, but, you know, I'll just give you one more, is I believe that the research on the low end of the spectrum will be very difficult. And I believe that on the higher end of the spectrum, it will be easier. And the reason is on the low end, you're dealing with kids. In many cases, they can't communicate well. Whereas on the high end, if it is truly a spectrum and everybody has the same generalized issue, on the high end of the spectrum, you're dealing with adults who can say what they feel and kind of explain what's going on. And that maybe that some of those things that are figured out there can then apply through to the kids. It feels a little to me like, As a kindergarten kid, like trying to take on calculus before like going through like grade 1 through grade 12 and that kind of stuff. So it seems like it's a very tough way to tackle it. So that would be my only thought.
I think we really have to look at including everyone in different types of research. And I think because it's easier to do research with higher functioning individuals with autism who have more language and who have less impaired cognitive skills, that they are the ones who are much better represented in studies. And my feeling is that we have to make sure that we are not, we have to make sure that we are making room and that we are funding studies that look at these specific and unique challenges of individuals who, in addition to autism, also have cognitive disability and who have other symptoms associated with autism, issues regarding epilepsy or sleep or a lot of the comorbid.
Or, you know, sensory issues as well.
So we have to make sure that we're not excluding those individuals from research opportunities simply because it's hard to include them. I think we have to make sure that we really reach out to that community to make sure that we are understanding and developing treatments for them, understanding what's causing their issues, their comorbid issues, as well as the autistic symptoms, and that we're developing treatments that are specifically tied to some of those additional issues.
Yeah, I mean, it's a critical problem, and we've got to solve it. And so it's
well
a great thing to work on. Is there anything else that you would like to talk about before we wrap up?
Well, I always like to encourage everyone, not just parents who are concerned about their children, but everyone to learn the signs of autism. I think, you know, we go around all the time and we say, learn the signs, but I think it's critical that whenever there's an opportunity in the media to talk about the signs, that we talk about them and talk about our own experience with how our children were diagnosed so that people can be aware. Because, you know, again, any time when a parent is concerned that their child is not meeting developmental milestones, they should talk to their doctor and not wait. There's no harm that comes from asking your doctor questions. So, you know, my own situation with my daughter, I always felt like, well, I should have known sooner because of my brother. But every child with autism is unique and different. But I always encourage families, if they suspect that their child's not meeting their milestones, talk to your doctor. You know, in Jody's case, she didn't babble. She never pointed. She never waved bye-bye. She never shook her head yes or no. She didn't show interest in other children. She didn't respond to her name when I would call her. She played with toys in very odd and unusual ways. Her language was very repetitive in that she was basically just parroting things that she heard me read to her in books or she heard other people say, but she never used words really to communicate. And these are all early warning signs of autism. And it's just so important that every parent know the early warning signs and talk to their doctor if they are concerned. You know, every parent knows the physical milestones. Every parent knows when their child is supposed to roll over, how many months it should be till they sit up, when they should walk. We all know those physical milestones. But it's just as important for families to know the developmental milestones. You know, when should a child have words? When should a child show social interest in other people? When should a child start to gesture and point? What are the typical physical milestones that have to do with social skills? So, you know, all of these early warning signs are listed on the Autism Science Foundation website. They're listed on the Centers for Disease Control website. But the key is not to wait. The key is to talk to your doctor early if there's an issue so that kids can start early intervention. Because early intervention is still the best weapon we have against preventing the most debilitating aspects of autism from ever surfacing in the first place. So that's really, I think, if you ask me for one last thing, that would be my closing point, is that if you are a parent and you are concerned or you suspect, don't wait, talk to your doctor.
Great. Well, Allison, thank you very much for doing the interview.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.